Okay. So what we're going to do today is in the first part of the class, we're going to sort of do a run, or a quick run through the rise of Islam and the basic principles of Islam. And then we will come back. On the way, we'll encounter Jews. Jews are always there right at the very beginning. And then we will, I suggest you sit, look further down, because I'm going to be in front, because I'm going to be playing the PowerPoint. And then we'll go more into detail. In the meantime, I printed these at home, so there are two pages instead of back and forth. I know I violated the rules, but I can't help that. Here. I put it in the, what's it called? Here. There's going to be an extra page. All right. This is Muhammad's signature in Arabic, as you know. Can you lower, are there curtains? There was an extra copy of it. What? That's better? Okay. So, as you know, Islam is very, very machmir, even more machmir than Judaism about representation of human beings. Certainly not, you will never see on Arab TV or anything, a picture of Muhammad, or certainly not of any of his members of his family. I will modify that in a minute. Okay. What's going on here? Okay. There are two, there maybe, are there three sheets?
I think there are three. Don't go for one, two and three. I don't know, the three of us are sitting here with three different sheets.
Yeah, there are three pages. I'm sorry. My mistake. There's three pages. Okay. Islam starts. Okay. 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 Islam starts here. Okay. This is the Arabian Peninsula. It was not the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. It's only been Saudi Arabia since the 20s. The Arabian Peninsula, overwhelmingly, that's why I said, maybe sit over there.
Yeah.
I can't help it. That, okay, this is the Arabian Peninsula. Most of it is not habitable. Okay, most of it is not habitable. You obviously, in order to live, you need water. So that settlement is determined according to access to water sources. The most important two areas of the Arabian Peninsula at the time, we're talking in the 6th century. What's going on in the 6th century? The Byzantine Empire, the Roman Empire of the East is here. The Parsim are over here. That the Gemara is being redacted at the time. Or maybe it's already redacted. It's a big machlokus among scholars. Most of the along the coast of the Red Sea, Arabs who live in the Arabian Peninsula generally are involved, largely involved in trade. The east-west trade, which has been the most important trade route always between China and India and Europe and North Africa and so on, goes, one of the major routes goes through Egypt, down to the Red Sea, and around to India. One of the major land routes goes from Yemen to this area called the Hejaz, we'll talk about in a minute, up the King's Road, Derech HaMelech, to Damascus. Okay? Part of Derech HaMelech is Route 60, which is the reason why, by the way, Shar Shechem is called Damascus Gate, because the same road, if we were able to travel it, goes past, you know, Kriyas Yishim goes to Shechem, and then goes on to Damascus. That's a major trade route. Okay. The RR, what's going to interest us is this area here. It's called the Hejaz. The Hejaz is a very fertile area, which gives rise to really the only major cities on the west bank of the Arabian Peninsula. The only other area which is important historically at the time is down here. It's Yemen and Aden, but that's not going to be part of our discussion at the moment. I'll just throw you a bone though. There was a Jewish king like in the late 5th century, early 6th century of Yemen. In any event, the three major cities in the Hejaz are Mecca. It's port, which is called Jeddah, and a city north of Mecca, which is known generally as Medina, but actually its original name was Yathrib. There were those who argue, as we'll see in a minute, there were those who argue that it became known as El Medina because of the Jews. There was a very large Jewish community there, and the word Medina in Mishnaic Hebrew means a city-state. Hamevi get mimdinat hayam, the city-state. So apparent, and it's not a regular Arabic usage. So it's very, very likely or possible that the Jews called it Al-Medina, and that sort of stuck. Okay. In any event, that's where all the action happens. The Arabs have been there forever and ever. This is their homeland. And Mecca is the hub of all commercial and political activity in the Hejaz. Mecca has the advantage, we'll see in a minute, of also being the religious center of, even before Islam, the religious center of the area. Every tribe has its own god, and all the gods are found in a temple located on top of a black stone known as the Kaaba. Okay, which is still the case. All right, again. I'm about to tell you. Okay, hold on. What's going on here? Okay. Muhammad is born in 570. So we're talking about but he starts his mission in 610. So we're talking about the Arabian Peninsula before 610. Okay. Before Muhammad receives his first vision or his first prophecy is known as the age of Jahiliyyah. Jahiliyyah means ignorance. The period when the Arabs did not worship Allah. Well, they worshipped Allah. They thought he was the king of the gods, not the only god. The traditional, here you have actually a bas-relief showing worshipping of the goddess of the moon. Okay. Pre-Islamic religion is polytheistic. Everybody worships everybody else's gods. Every tribe has their own god. It's heavily based on a reverence for natural forces, and as might be expected from religion which is in the desert, the sun at the center of attention. The gods are, among others, Allah. Allah is the chief god. Al-Manat, Al-Uzat, the moon goddess. In addition, they're sort of like stage two gods. They are the jinn. They're sort of like little... This is not Robin Williams playing the genie in Aladdin. Oh, that's where it comes from. The jinn are like little demons, like little kids. You know, we would call them mazikin. In Ireland, they call them leprechauns. I mean, these are all sort of like second level powers that have to be propitiated, and they're a major force in religious awareness. In the second half of the 6th century, approximately, something happens to the Arabs which has already happened to a significant degree elsewhere. And that is that, for whatever reason, the traditional polytheistic religion begins to tank. One of the things that set the stage for the spread of Christianity was the fact that people said, I couldn't take Jupiter and Juno and all these guys seriously anymore, and they started looking at something more sophisticated and more. And among other things, Christianity and Judaism and Mithraism and all kinds of other possibilities started converting Romans to some kind of more sophisticated religion. Something similar happens on the Arabian Peninsula. For a lot of people, there's a lot of searching going on in the second half of the 6th century. A lot of this searching, centers on individuals, charismatic, spiritual seekers, who are known as Hanifi. A Hanif is a person with a large soul who sees beyond the gods and preaches some kind of morality, and so on and so forth. In Indian terms, they say it's a mahatma, a great spirit. That's in fact how that reality is reflected in one place in the Quran, where Allah says to the Muhammad says, recite. Allah speaks the truth. Therefore, go in the footsteps of the religion of Abraham, who acted as a Hanif, and was not counted among the idolaters. Abraham was the founder of the real religion, Islam, but he lived among others who were also working in similar directions. So, in other words, Muhammad didn't come out of nowhere. There was a sort of like broad tendency towards searching for something, a greater truth, especially among the urban Arabs, as opposed to the Arabs who still like live like Bedouins. They tended to be more conservative, and that's sort of a town-country kind of division. I have to say one word. The Arabs were generally not, most Arabs were not literate in the sense of being able to read and write. That does not mean they were not cultured. The Arabic language was a central part of Arab culture, especially a very long and established and elaborate and sophisticated tradition of Arabic poetry, which later had a profound impact on Jews, because to a significant degree, medieval poetry, as it was created in Spain by Ibn Firol and Menachem Ibn Saruk and Donish Ben Labrat and all these names that we know from the Zemirot, was an adaptation and basically a response to a challenge that the Arabs would say, look, we have this wonderful, you know, language, let's see you do something similar in both linguistically and belletristically and in terms of scansion and meters and rhyme, stuff like that. So Jewish poets responded by actually transforming Hebrew and creating such an incredible heritage of poetry. But this is something which preceded Islam. That's important to keep in mind, because we're not talking about a bunch of primitives. Europeans have a tendency to underappreciate and affect other groups. The nature of polytheism is that it's preeminently tolerant. Because if you have more than one god, what's the difference? Right? So the Torah says, for example, in Shemot, not like having a Chumash. Listen, I still buy books. It's not like I'm like, totally. In fact, I can't read without a book. I mean, I read at night in the second luchot, in the context of the second luchot. So the Torah says as follows. Yud. Hishamer lecha. Pen tichrot brit liyoshev haaretz asher ata basha ba'aleha pen yihye lemokesh bekirbecha. Okay. Ki et mizbechotan tetotzun ve et matzvotan tetshaberun ve et asherot tichrotun. Ki lo tishtachaveh le'el acher ki Hashem kana shemo ke'el kana hu. Pen tichrot brit liyoshev haaretz vizanu acharei elohehem vizavchu elohehem vekara lecha v'achalta mizivcho. He'll invite you for dinner. Ma kama. The deal is that there's no such thing as secularism. It's religious. And the idea is that, you know, we're all, what's the word? Inclusive. So therefore, I invite you to my house, and I ask you to say thanks to God Almighty, Creator of Shemayim V'aretz. But then I'm expected to go to your house and, you know, lie bait to Zeus or whoever, Baal or whoever. And that's part of the deal. That's just polite. Right? So as a result, the Torah says you can't get involved in this. So ironically, the Torah here is against tolerance in that regard, because you can't tolerate avodah zarah. That's where it stops. And that's why the Jews are accused in Roman and Greek literature of being impolite and being arrogant and being whatever. Yeah, because you won't, have you heard this before? How come you won't eat in my house? So, you know, and that usually comes up within the four amas of Jews. Never mind. Okay, why can't you give respect to my God? What's wrong with you? Torah says no. That you've got to avoid that trap as much as possible. But the flip side is that by definition, paganism. What's the difference? More gods, less gods. What's the difference? And that's what the Kaaba was. So all the gods of all the, of the, of the Arabs were, you know, floating around and represented in the Kaaba. The best example, however, we don't know what the Kaaba looked like before, after, before it became the sole monument to, or sanctuary to Allah exclusively. But we do have an idea how it worked elsewhere. In Rome, opposite the Fontana Trevi, is the building of the Pantheon, which was built, actually later, by Hadrian, but the first edifice was built by Marcus Agrippa, the friend of Augustus Caesar, and it was meant to include all the gods. Pantheon means all the gods. Pan is everything. Theon is for the gods. If you go in, you see, well, now it's a church, but alright, that's, I leave that to your own discretion. But in the inside is this huge dome full with niches. And at one time, all the gods that worshipped in the Roman Empire, and that's a lot of gods, okay, had the little representative in the Pantheon. And you can see, I'll actually try to upload the PowerPoint. You see that there, you know, the whole dome was, get the sense of, you know, Mehala Zen and Tzamin. We're all sort of together in this, everybody worships everybody else. I told you that you're not supposed to have pictures of human beings of Muhammad. How did I get this? There, among some Shiites, there is a tradition that's actually mutter to portray Muhammad. This is a traditional picture of Muhammad, it's actually Persian. If you got caught with this picture in Saudi Arabia, well, you wouldn't, nobody in this room would get caught in Saudi Arabia anyways, but if you were caught in Saudi Arabia, that would be your last day with this picture. Anyways, the story, so you're talking about an Arab population which is searching, sophisticated, in Mecca, living on the major trade routes, and therefore exposed to all kinds of people who come. It's very cosmopolitan, because Jews come and Christians come, Somalis, all kinds of people show up in Mecca, and you talk. What do you talk? I mean, listen, there's no soccer. There's a limit to what you can talk about in terms of the weather, because the weather there is about as, it's about as consistent as our weather, right? Exactly. With all due respect to Barry Lynn, you know, it's not only for my friend in Southampton, in Northampton, Massachusetts, who has got snow on the ground today. In any event, so what do you talk? You talk religion. That's what people talk about. Which is one of the reasons why, for example, in Christian Europe, Rashi puts a tremendous amount of anti-Christian polemic or Jewish responses to Christian polemic in the parish, because he had to basically arm his people for encounters with Christians who also do this stuff. Okay. In any event, this is the hero of our story, or the anti-hero, depending on how you look at it, is Muhammad. Muhammad was born into the dominant tribe in Mecca, the Quraysh, into one of the poorer families thereof. The Quraysh ran Mecca. They also ran the holy places in the holy place, in other words, the Kaaba with all the gods. Therefore, during pilgrimage time, there's a time during the year that everybody would come to on Hajj to Mecca. And that's when there was actually an armistice. They had to stop any intramural wars that were going on between the tribes, had to stop during that period of time. Mecca itself was supposed to already then not have any bloodshed go on there, because it's haram, it's off limits. It's extraterritorial, if you want, like D.C. Haram is from, it's asur. Haram means asur. So, yeah, it's really like haram. It's like haram. In Arabic, that's what I mean. Haram al-Sharif is the area where prohibited something. We'll have to see what that means. Well, by the way, why is it called a harem when you have like 85 women?
It's a sore
for a guy, unless he's been fixed, to go in. Alright? In any event, so Muhammad is born into a cadet part of the family known as the Banu Hashim. If the name Hashim, of the word Hashim, if the name Hashim means, sounds familiar? Hashemite. The Hashemites are, in fact, direct descendants of Muhammad, Sharif Hussein, who was the father of Abdullah and Faisal, who later became the king of Iraq until they were overthrown in the 50s. They were the custodians of the holy places. I mean, all the Hashemites, that's why Hussein used to make a big deal about being a Hashemite. And we always say, you don't just say Jordan, you say the Hashemite children of King Jordan, because his yichus is a big part of this whole to do. When the Jordanians want to make, when the Jordanians want to make the Saudis nuts, so they'll make a big deal about the fact that one of the cousins is the Sharif of the Holy Places officially. You know, because he arguing that they're not legitimate because they're not Johnny come lately, as opposed to us, we are descended from the, there's a zillion descendants of the Prophet, but that's a big deal with them. In any event, he was born in around 570, to a, as I said, a cadet part of the family. His father died when he was young. He was raised by his uncles. He was sent at a young age of Mecca into the desert to live with members of the family who are still living a traditional Arabic nomadic kind of existence, to tough him up and get and instill him with the traditions of the desert. And at an early age, 18, 19, so what would that be? That would be like 15, almost 15, let's say by 590, he makes money the old-fashioned way. He marries it. He marries a very wealthy distant cousin whose name is Khadija, and he becomes not only she's 38, 39, he's 18, 19, and he becomes not only her husband, but also he becomes the director general of her very extensive commercial enterprises. And that leads him apparently to travel. He gets to Damascus, and goes to Damascus. He meets all kinds of people, and he's a very, very smart, very charismatic, very spiritual individual. I personally don't think you need to sit there and dump on somebody in order to say, I don't agree, or he's my enemy, or whatever. I think on the contrary, I think a respectful position is the better way. It's actually better from a self-defense point of view. So he's a clearly very, very smart, very deep, spiritual, extremely charismatic guy. I wouldn't be surprised. This is not what he looked like, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was also good looking. I mean, it's sort of like his combination of things. And he becomes like a Hanif. He becomes one of these people who is no longer happy with the traditional religion, and he starts Tayo de Chardin once said, called inner yearnings. He has this feeling there's something more. So he talks to a lot of Christians. There's a lot of Jews in the Hejaz. Who these Jews were, we'll talk about in a sec. We'll meet them in a second. Who these Jews were was always a matter of debate. Now it's pretty much assumed that these are Jews who have been there for a very long time in the Arabian Peninsula. Judging from outside reports and also what you can sort of cull from things that Muhammad himself says, these are Jews who are more or less from Jews with an orientation towards Babel. There's too much Medrash and too much Torah Shebal Peh that you can hear in the Quran and in its attendant literature that he didn't go to Babel to go learn. He didn't go to Babel to go study in yeshiva. So obviously got it from these Jews, and apparently they had really a very strong connection with Torah Shebal Peh in some way. I'm not saying they were like Gedolei Olam, but they were not proto-Karaites, they were not sort of a Tzivor for dimension. These are, as from as you can be in those times in an area which is pretty rough and tumble and living a nomadic existence, they were pretty normative Jews. They were extremely militant, they were very good warriors, by the way. They probably came from Eretz Israel at some point. They wandered south and business, or whatever the case might be. That's how Jews came to China. Because, the only ones who could cross the lines between the Christians and the Jews. That too. No, but there's an opportunity, and you know what? Jews come to China because, especially the Iraqi Jews mainly, they're trying to reopen the East-West trade routes, and Muslims aren't trusted in Christian countries, and vice versa. The Jew can go anywhere. His powerlessness is his weakness is his power. And also, when this happens, like in the 8th century, 9th century, the Gemara is already established pretty much as the universally accepted constitution of the Jewish people, so that a guy from France who has a din Torah with a guy from Egypt can get a psak in Samarkand that he could get at home. I mean, this is very, talking about international, So when the Koreans say that it's because we study Gemara that we run the world, not quite, but there is something to it. Okay. All we know is, we don't know much about his previous life, but in 610, he has a revelation. And in the revelation, the angel Gabriel comes to him and says, recite in the name of God, So it's called the Surah, the Fatiha, the opening prayer. All it's also recited as part of the opening prayer every 5 times a day. Say what you're supposed to say. We'll see that in a sec. Okay. So here we said he was born in 570. He married Khadija in 590. His first prophecy in 610 is as follows. Then the angel Gabriel came to him and said, recite. And he, Muhammad, said, how shall I recite? For I cannot recite. Then he grabbed me and squeezed me until my strength ebbed. Then he released me and said, recite. I said, I do not recite. Then he said, recite in the name of your creator who created man from a thick drop. Recite, for he will give you wisdom, for he is full of compassion, who taught with a pen, taught man that which he did not know. And that's his moment. And his major message is out with Avodah Zarah. And his first purpose is to destroy the traditional Arab religion and substitute it in belief in one God, exclusive God, Allah. Now, Allah was the name of the king of the gods earlier. He's saying, you got it wrong, is it? By the way, Allah is a Kodesh Baruch Hu. There are many Muslims who will say not like that today, certainly more radical ones, but Allah is a certainly perfectly legitimate, you can say, Baruch Ata Allah, Melech HaOlam, not as a kinoi, not for nothing that, you know, Rav Avadya Yosef, he was named after the chief rabbi of Baghdad, who was Chacham Abdallah Somich, Abdallah Ovadia. In fact, that's the Rambam's last name. The Rambam's real name was Musa bin Maimun bin Abdallah. Abdallah was the Elter Zeta, who was a Rav in Cordova, and that's why the Rambam, one of the names that keeps floating up, there's certain names that keep popping up in the Rambam's family. One of them is Maimon, and one of them is Moshe, and one of them is David, and one of them is Ovadia, because of this Abdallah. But there's not, and you can say Hamdallah, and you can say, whatever, Allah is God. Okay? So therefore, when you translate see what the Shahada is. When you translate the central statement of Islam, it's La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulallah. We usually translate, there is no God but Allah. It's not true. There is no God but God. And Muhammad is his prophet. So any Jew can sign off on the first part. Now what's interesting with regard, if we're already looking at these, at this opening, surah means perek, sha'ar. That's how, by the way, if you look in Svarim, that Svarim are divided into Sha'arim, that's a direct Arabic influence, because in general, by us, a book is divided into Prakim. The Mishnah is divided into Prakim. If you already have books that are divided into Sha'arim, then that's just a holdover. Also, by the way, it was the Arabs who invented the introduction to books. You'll never find a Jewish book with an introduction before that. That's something that they invented, which was taken over by us. Okay, I just want to call your attention to something very interesting. We're not going to do this inside because we're having a lot of time. Notice what Muhammad's first response was. He says, recite. I said, I can't recite.
Moshe.
Not just Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu says, I can't talk. I forget about the being a stutterer. I meant he couldn't talk. He wasn't a public speaker. It's not just Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeshayahu. What happens when he has his first, in Perek Vav, has his first revelation, and he comes into the Beis HaMikdash, or he sees the Beis HaMikdash, he says, Oili kidmeti, ki ish tmei svataim anochi, v'mtoch amin tmei svataim ani yoshev. And what happens? The Amalek goes and takes a coal and puts it in his head to purify his mouth so he can talk. It probably is a reverse image too, because the coal comes from the altar, which probably represents God's word, and puts it into his bread. Not just them. Yirmiyahu, first Perek. I'm young, too young. I can't talk. I don't know how to be able to express myself. Kanal Yechezkel. What's the deal with Yechezkel? Yechezkel. All right, we all get caught up with the George Lucas effects in chapter 1 and 2 in the Merkavah. But at the end of the day, God gives Yechezkel a book, and he has to eat the book to put his word inside. So this motif clearly is a biblical motif, which then Yonah runs away from the implications of his own. That's true. Yonah's problem is that he speaks too well. He knows he's going to be very convincing, and they're going to go and do tshuva. In any event, so this is a blatant example of clear Jewish. You know, I don't know, lifting. You hear a lot of things, and it comes out. You've subconsciously reworked things. Sometimes, I mean, one of the more interesting, I'll just mention in passing. One of the more interesting, so Bible stories he knows, and he gets them backwards, or he changes them, or whatever, I mean, or he dreams them. So the one who, so the Akedah is not Yitzchak, it's Yishmael, and it's not in Harabayit, it's on the Kaaba. Okay. So Bible stories he knows. He may even, there seems to be not a little amount of use of Torah Shebaal Peh too. I'll give you one example that my teacher and colleague and friend, Professor Beryl Septimus from Harvard, told me, I don't know if he published it or not, but told me that there is a hadith, there's a story that, in the Torah Shebaal Peh of Islam, there's a story that Muhammad, at this revelation, Muhammad hears a voice, and he thinks it's the voice of his friend Abu Bakr. Now Abu Bakr later became the first Khalif, and he was one of the first Muslims. And he thinks he hears the name, but they were friends before. And he thinks he hears the voice of Abu Bakr. He said, no, it's Allah speaking. Now, I don't know if you know, but I'm sure you know. In Paragimel, in Shemot, the Torah says, I know, God appears to Moshe Rabbeinu from the Sneh, and he says, Anochi Elokei Avicha. So Chazal say he heard a voice that sounded like his father, Amram. And he said, is that you, father? And God says, no, Anochi Elokei Avicha. So this is a motif. It's not a normal motif that you would think to hear. So he argues, and I think he's right, that this is actually a medrash that sort of like made it into and was then converted to Islam. Okay, let's go further.
Yes,
because he met Christians and he knew something about Jesus' life. Clearly, one thing he rejects totally, and Islam rejects absolutely to this day, is the idea that Jesus is the Son of God. The kid doesn't go, just like we do. They call him a prophet, although it's interesting, on the other hand, Jesus' official name is Isa ibn Maryum, Jesus son of Mary. But the truth of the matter is, if you don't buy into the virgin birth thing, then it should be Ibn Yusuf. So I don't know why that is, but it's Isa ibn Maryum. So here you have actually a picture. It's hard to see of Muhammad at his first. He goes ascending to heaven. Okay, so he preaches against idolatry. He says the Kaaba has to be purified to the worship of the one God, which got him in Dutch immediately. With his older cousins who were running the Kaaba, for whom it wasn't just a matter of their status as priests or as custodians of the holy places, but during pilgrimage time, you make a few bucks. Okay. Okay, hold on. His cousins were against it because he was endangering their hachnasa, and also he was a revolutionary. So around 10 years he goes around and he goes home after his first revelation, and actually his wife Khadija, his best friend Abu Bakr, and all the members of his family accept Islam. What does Islam mean? It's already floating around the word. The word does not mean shalom. Anybody who says it doesn't know what they're talking about. The word Islam means submission. It's like Kabbalah Sol Machu Shamayim. Submission to the word of God. If you wanted a Hebrew equivalent, it's like ani mashlim im mashu. I'm willing to make my peace with something, which means I accept a reality that I'm not happy with, or I accept the reality, or make my peace with something. That's not making peace. That's like saying that's resignation. Islam means submission, submitting to the will of Allah. For about 10 years, he preaches around and he tries to, and he gets, there are people who are looking, and he's a charismatic guy, and he teaches and whatever, and that makes him more and more a persona non grata among, with the elites and with his relatives and with the people who still hold on to the old religion. This is not simple stuff. A lot of his early revelations, also deal with Jews. We're going to talk about that maybe today, maybe next week. What's important is that, one of his most important acts around the year 620 is the flight to the farthest mosque. he has a dream, he actually does, he gets on his horse, Al-Burak, and he goes to heaven. The question is, what happened? He goes from the nearest mosque to the farthest mosque, Masjid Al-Aqsa, Al-Aqsa HaKatseh. There are those interpreters. It's a dream, there are those who say it really happened. Masjid means a place of worship. Okay, but he's not talking about mosques, it's a place to worship. Misgad is a place in Hebrew, is a place to, what's this god? To worship. Misgad is a place to worship.
The word Islam only came about after he had his revelation?
Yeah, verb that he used for accepting, like Kabbalah is Malchus Shemayim, Lahavdil.
Yeah.
What type of call it Islam? It's a process. As a form of religion, not. But that's what you do. You become a Muslimum. Right. You become committed. You submit. Okay. Yeah. Now, let me say something about this business with Al-Aqsa. South of Mecca are two mosques. One of them is the nearest mosque, Masjid Al-Idna, and Masjid Al-Aqsa. Masjid Al-Idna is closer to Mecca. Masjid Al-Aqsa is farther from Mecca, the south of Mecca. Apparently, that is what is referred to in the Quran and in the tradition. Okay? Nothing to do with Jerusalem. We'll see in a minute where Jerusalem figures in. The idea that Jerusalem is where he from Jerusalem went to heaven. I don't know if you know the name. There was a professor who passed away not long ago. It was past summer. Professor R.J.Z. Verblovsky from Hebrew University. He's originally from Tel Aviv. He's an interesting guy. Anyways, he used to teach comparative religions. He once said, you see from the story that he flew from Mecca to Jerusalem and then to heaven, that there were no direct flights to heaven from Mecca at the time. You had to have a layover in Jerusalem. Yes. No, you wouldn't go anywhere if you went at Allah. Did they solve it? It's still good. Hey, listen, I understand that. If I made 120,000 shekel a month, I would also say I want more. Okay. In any event, the idea that Jerusalem is to be identified with the farthest mosque pops up, albeit as a minority interpretation of the Quran after Muhammad dies. And it really only gets a life of its own and gets a push in the second half of the 7th century, way after Muhammad dies. Why? Because by that time, the heirs of Muhammad, the ones who are the new first caliph, the first dynasty of Khalifim, are the Umayyads. You can see they're building all over the southern wall. And in fact, there's Umayyad stuff all over the places that they built like crazy. They had actually set up their capital in Damascus. And at the time, and corrupt. And at the time, there was a revolt against them in Mecca and in the Hejaz in general, saying these guys don't deserve to administer the holy places, and so we're separating from them. So, but that meant the Umayyads had no place for pilgrimage, and pilgrimage is a major mitzvah in Islam. So they decided to take a tramp on the tradition that Al-Aqsa is in Jerusalem in order to be able to validate and legitimize their own rule. See, we have a place that's connected with the Prophet too, until we can go get the real holy places. But he goes up to heaven in 620. This may also be a Moses echo, because Moshe Rabbeinu also goes up to heaven to get the Torah. The Meccans are very not happy with him, because he calls their entire legitimacy into question. And just then, 620, 621, opens up. North of Mecca, the only other major city in the Hejaz that's worth talking about at the moment is called Medina. Al-Medina was actually ruled by Jewish tribes up until the middle of the 6th century. Subsequent to that, Arab tribes took over, and basically the Jewish tribe became junior partners in running the city. The city was divided into three or four units. Each one had a dominant Arab pagan tribe, and a sort of a junior Jewish tribe living in that area. And there was constant internecine warfare between the various parts of the city. So the Arabs decided, okay, this is crazy. We need to stop this constant the constant battles between between the tribes within the precincts of the city and so on. It's bad for business. By the way, that, if you think that that's like sounds bizarre, you should know that that's the reason. If you ever visit Italy, all of the palaces, all the palazzi, are all fortresses because every one of them belongs to a different noble house, and you know, they send their guys and constantly attack back and forth. You see that in Rome, you see it in Florence, you see it in Siena. It's all over the place. In any event, so they look for somebody who was going to help them, sort of make Seder, make order, and they said, well, there's this guy in Mecca who's a religious person. He's a Hanif. He's a great soul, and he, you know, we'll invite him. And they invite him to come as an outside sort of like unprejudiced you know figure to make peace and harmony among the tribes in Medina. He agrees on condition that all the pagans accept Islam. They said yes, we'll abandon our gods, we'll only worship Allah. They became known as the Ansar, the helpers in El Medina. Which the Jews will see in a minute. So, and then slowly he starts moving his people out of Mecca till he finally himself leaves Mecca in 622 in what is known as the Hijra. Hagira, the transfer from Mecca to Medina, that is year zero in the Muslim calendar. The Muslim date is AH, after Hijra. After the Hijra, so everything is, it's either BH or AH. Okay. 622 according to our calendar. Now, you can't just add 620 to any, to the regular day to get the Arabic year, because they have a lunar year. So every year that they have they go into minus 11 day mode, which is what sometimes you can have Ramadan in the summer, God help them. I have such rahmanis, I mean, you know. But the worst thing is to see in a hot Ramadan afternoon in Rami Levi with the Christian cashiers and they're waving food underneath it's very cruel.
One of them told me that I saw a guy in his car. He would not drink meat in front of them. And he went and sat in his car.
Okay, I'm glad to see that because I've seen the opposite. Anyways, it's good to know. In any event, and you can have it twice a year that way. I mean, there are sometimes a calendar year you can have Ramadan in March and you can have Ramadan again in December or early January or whatever. So in 622 he moves to Medina. Hijra 622. Okay. I'm going to be very very brief here. There's a long discussion from 622 to 630. A bunch of things go on. First of all, he has to consolidate his control in Medina. The Jews don't like him. They will not accept Islam. He doesn't like them. They don't like him. Not a happy situation. There are Jews who convert, okay, but generally they do not. Number one. Number two, the constant war back and forth between him and the Meccans over trade routes, over who rules the Kaaba. It's a lot of different things together. There are a number of very serious battles that go on between the Meccans, and generally the Jews will join, and the Jews in Medina will ally themselves with the Meccans against Muhammad. Muhammad wins almost consistently. Every time a Jewish tribe loses, they're either put to the sword, men, women, and children. In one case, they're thrown out of El Medina and sent north to the northern part of the Hejaz. Whatever the case might be, it doesn't end good. And in the context, when we look at we'll probably get to this next time. When we look at some of the verses in the Quran, a lot of these things are said against the background of this ongoing war against the Jews.
On the impression when we talk about medieval times that the Christians were the one who slaughtered the Jews and the Muslim countries were more tolerant. I don't know, that was
later.
That's much later. And just because the Jews were not massacred as much by Muslims doesn't mean that their life was Gan Eden, which is made. That idea of the so-called golden age in Spain, in convivencia, everybody loved each other, blah, 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 that was made up by a bunch of yekkes in the 19th century. German Jewish historians is trying to advance an agenda of equality in Europe. Yes, it was worse under the Christians. Because as we'll see, according to Islam, the Jews have a place within the Dar al-Islam, as opposed to Augustine, which we saw, he had a sort of like, you know, had to improvise something. And you don't have this sort of a Christ killer kind of thing in Islam, but as we'll see, I'm gonna tell you, I already disclosed next week the major point. There were very, very strict rules under which Jews are allowed to live under Muslim rule. If they violate them, they forfeit their right to live. Okay, so we have forfeited our right to live under Islam by being here. Because we are not subject, we do not pay the jizya, we do not pay the haraj. We have an army, we rule over land which is owned by Muslims, and which belongs to the Dawah al-Islam. We rule over Muslims. All of that is nothing less than blasphemy. So I'm going to tell you something now, I'm going to wait till next week. It is a religious conflict. It has always been a religious conflict. And anybody says anything otherwise, either doesn't know what he's talking about, or is trying to double deal. I can't be more emphatic about it.
And therefore no negotiation.
There's nothing to negotiate. If somebody came up to me and said, look, here's a shas, I will make world peace, you toss out Sanhedrin. I'm not doing that. Take Sefer Vayikra, toss it in the gutter, and you can have world peace. No, sorry. It's disrespectful to ask that. Could you reinterpret Vayikra in order to be able to provide world peace? Yes! That's what Western secular arrogance gets you. Yeah, throw them a few bucks, they'll sell their souls. Maybe you will.
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
Sure.
When we discuss Christianity, and now we're discussing Islam, it seems like Jews were faster to convert to Christianity than Islam. Was there something more attractive about it?
No, plenty of Jews converted to Islam. All the questions are in terms of conversions. You have conversions. The normal thing is to convert. The normal thing is to leave your religion and to join the majority. Everybody wants to be cool. Everybody wants to be a celeb. Everybody wants to be on Twitter.
A thousand likes.
But the fact that Jews in Muslim countries and in Christian countries converted to the major religion is not a surprise. The fact that so few did, that's what's an enigma. That's what's an enigma. We'll see in a little bit that when it took time. The huge tracts of land and area territories that the Muslims conquered in the first push from 632 to 750, were all Christians. All these people in North Africa and all throughout the Middle East, they were all Christians. There may be a few pagans left. They're all Christians. And over the centuries, they became Muslims. The only ones who didn't get with the program were the Jews. Okay. So you have ongoing wars back and forth. Jews keep losing. It's not that Muhammad didn't try his best to get the Jews to sign on. The truth is, originally he said you can pray towards Jerusalem, the Qibla, the original direction of Tefillah. For a short period of time, it could be to Jerusalem. Really, he said, we'll give up, you know, we don't have, instead of Ramadan, he suggested they fast on Yom Kippur, they don't eat pork anyways, they're more machmir with pork than we are, because we play football, they won't even touch a football because it's pigskin. Things like that. But the Jews said, no, we have the original, you know, item, so we're not interested. And so at that point, he switched everything around back, he was machmir, played daven 5 times a day. But it was a short-lived business, and then he sort of went back to war mode.
Which two cities again did you say the Hijra
was from Mecca to Medina. Here's Mecca, and here's Medina. Now, okay. Yeah, they're both in the Hijaz, in the western part, the western, west central part of Saudi Arabia. Okay, the only thing I want to say about all these battles back and forth, it's a long discussion, are two things which are mentioned in contemporary discourse, in political discourse, that are related directly to these battles. Number one, at one point, we're going to start draining you a couple of dates and places, at one point, Muhammad lost to the Meccans. So he said, I will declare a hudna, a treaty, a ceasefire between us. Now a hudna, what's a hudna? The idea was that you take a time out to be able to put yourself in a position to be able to renew hostilities at the earliest opportunity. It is not a peace treaty. It's a regroup to get ready to attack. And he did. As soon as he was able to, he violated the hudna to get at the Meccans. So that's number one. Number two, the other one is the story of Khaybar. Let me see if it's here. Yes. Khaybar was a city, one of the great Jewish tribes, The Banu always say Nokia. Kainuka. We're living in a town, in a fortified town called Khaibar. And one of the things he had, in order, and it was controlling Muhammad's flank. So he sent his son-in-law and cousin Ali, who was the fourth, the third caliph, and also the ancestor, the founder of the Shia, de facto. He sent him to go take Khaybar, and the defeat of the Jews and the slaughter of the Jewish defenders of Khaybar is a major, major moment in the story of the spread and the empowerment of Islam. There was, in fact, you can watch with subtitles. You can watch I'm sure it's a Hezbollah or Hamas miniseries, and you see how the Jews are portrayed and how Ali goes and fights the Jews there and so on. He basically takes the city because he's a one-on-one with the Jewish commander, who's this big, you know, gorilla that he has to fight. And you can tell who's Ali because Ali had a distinctive sword. But Khaybar is like one of these moments, these formative moments in Muslim collective memory, and it pops up actually in contemporary parlance. This is a video of a demonstration against an anti-Jewish demonstration in front of the shul in Tripoli in 2011. Let me see if I can get it to go. No, not supposed to do that. Can you hear it? Khaybar, Khaybar, Ya Yahud, Jaisha Muhammad, Sawfa Yahud, Khaybar, Khaybar, Ya Yahud, Jaisha Muhammad, what? Outside the shul in Libya. Khaybar, Khaybar, O Jew, the army of Muhammad is returning soon. You can hear it in demonstrations in New York, you can hear it in demonstrations in around the world, you can hear, there's a very classy, Hezbollah has a couple of music videos that they put out during Milchemet Levanon Ashniya, Khaybar, Khaybar, Ya Yahud, Jaisha Muhammad, Safa Yahud, knowing that the fate of Khaybar is what's waiting for you. In fact, there's even one video I found in New York of a demonstration in New York near the Israeli consulate where you hear something in the background going, they're saying Khaybar, Khaybar, oh my God! All right. They are, no, I'm not saying, no, the question, it's not anti, it's a matter of pro-Muslim. Islam is the way, that's what it says on all the bumper stickers. So the question is not, are they anti-Christian? They're not anti-Christian. Christianity, like Judaism, is rooted in the word of Allah. The question is, what now? And what place could these religions have in a Muslim polity? But let me get to this. So Muhammad in 630 comes, conquers Mecca, purifies the sanctuary. Islam is established as the religion of the Hejaz, and he dies in 632. He got sick and died. There are persistent reports maybe he was poisoned, but. And in 632, the forces of Islam, we'll see in a minute, break under Abu Bakr, and then under Umar ibn al-Khattab, after whose name the square in Fahin Shar Yafo is named, and then Ali, and then Uthman, and Muawiyah, and so on, all the Khalifim afterwards. Khalif means to succeed or to take one's place. Khalif, that's the word. It's really not, for our purposes, it's really not important what stages Islam went through and how did, and where was Muhammad at any particular time theologically. What's important historically is what was the faith and the perception and the view on the world and of the Jew and by extension on the Christian for the people who broke out of Arabia in 632 and within 100 years created an empire that went from southern France to Afghanistan. From 632 to 732. Oh, much bigger. And later they went on and took care of Afghanistan and went into northern India, then penetrated south into Africa. They got pushed back out of Europe, and then under the Ottomans, we forget that on September 11th, 1683, The combined armies of the Poles and the Habsburgs turned back the Ottomans at the gates of Vienna on September 11, 1683. And had they not won, Europe would already be Muslim. Bratislava, Pressburg used to be the capital of Hungary because Budapest was ruled by the Muslims. Romania, Hungary, all the Balkans, sure. What was going on? What was Lord Byron doing in Greece? The Greeks were fighting for their independence against the Turks. The Ottomans, in fact, there's not a bad movie called, it's Battle of Vienna, about the attempt by, to conquer Vienna in 1683 by, Kara Mustafa Pasha, who was the, great vizier of the Ottoman Empire. By the way, there is every reason to think, it turns out that September, Islam is very, 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 no, I'm, I no, lehefech, lehefech. The Muslims are very, history and historiography are very, very central in Arab culture. There is, and there is real reason to think, because there are other things happened September 11th also. I asked, my friend Mati Kedar, I said, is it possible that they timed this thing on September 11th as sort of like a payback? He said he never saw anything, any reference, but it shouldn't be dismissed. It's very, very likely, because there were other things that happened September 11th, certain victories that they had. I mean, you do things on a continuum. Yeah. All right. I'm not going to go when I teach this in depth, I go through all the pillars of Islam for our purposes, okay? There are five pillars of Islam. There's the Shahada, La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulallah, there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. And if you're a Shiite, you add that there's a special role for Ali, who is the... I really don't want to go into this. It's very complex. For our purposes, there is no difference. Okay? For our purposes. I mean, there are differences. And they hate each other as much as they hate us, if not more. But that's not the point. The point is that for purposes of where do the non-Muslims fit, I mean, it's fine-tuning. Okay? That's the first thing. Then you have tzalat, prayer five times a day, and you have zakat to give tzedakah, especially something. One of the major forms of tzedakah is actually kind of a ma'ot purim kind of thing, like a matan of yoinim. You give money to be able to have, so people can have an iftar after Ramadan. Then there's Ramadan, and then there's what else did I miss? Then there's the Hajj once in your life. Is that five? Okay. The Hajj is to go up to Mecca. Lachug in Hebrew means to walk around. Like Hamasok Chag Ba'avir. So you go around especially since they're not allowed to smoke, they're not allowed to, it's a very, very machmir. Muslims tend to, Islamic law is very machmir. It leads up, good question, why is Elul a month? It's a hachana, because the last 3 days of Ramadan lead up to Eid al-Fitr, and more importantly to Laylat al-Khalid, which is the day, marks the day that the first revelation came. It's kind of it's a Yom Kippur. It's kind of a Yom Kippur. By the way, Christians do it. How long is Lent? 40 days. Now, but I remember as a kid, that we used to get these, I mentioned this last week, we used to get these stupid calendars from the insurance brokers. What was always on on Friday? What picture of what? It was always a fish. To remind the Catholics, you're not supposed to eat meat. Yeah, the truth of the matter is, that's my kids get a kick out of this because I don't eat meat on Friday. But I don't eat meat on Friday, so, you know, Hachana l'Shabbat. But the Magen Avraham, but they say you're the last one doesn't eat meat on Friday. In any event, for our purposes, what's important is not those five, things, which we will get to. There's the Hajj.
Jeffrey, can I ask you a
Yes.
I'm historically challenged. Can
sure.
you remind me what's going on in Christianity?
Sure. While Muhammad is alive, the Byzantine Empire still rules from Greece, southern Italy, North Africa, all the way to the borders of Eretz Israel. The Parthians rule Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, southern Caucasus, and stuff like that. They are constantly fighting back and forth. In the West, the Franks have setting up their kingdom, the Merovingians are the kings. The Visigoths live in Spain, and they're busy persecuting the Jews, actually. The Vandals control North Africa. The Lombards rule in Italy. This is before Charlemagne. And you have various kingdoms, Slavic kingdoms, sort of pagan kingdoms in Eastern Europe. From a Jewish point of view, this is an era after the finishing of the Yerushalmi. There is a center of Eretz Yisrael in the Galil. We have a literature called, this is the period of Piyutim. This is the era of Yossi ben Yossi and Kalir and Yanai, largely. And in Bavel, they are finishing up. This is the period, it's that sort of, what's the word? Twilight era between the Amoraim and the Sfaraim, when the Gemara is being redacted, and it's after Ravina and Ravashi. Jews are not living in Baghdad yet. That happens only after the Abbasids take over in 750. They lift it up. It's not a center. There's still Matamaxia and Sura and Pumbedita and all these places that they talk about in the Gemara. That's more or less for our world. I mean, what was going on in China, I don't remember now which for some reason I think the Song Dynasty was there, but I'm not sure. Okay, anyway, we need to talk about this. The prime directive of Islam is to bring the world to accept, to submit to the will of Allah for the benefit of mankind to ensure its salvation. Nikuda. It's a good thing. Sorry, the Ekater. It's a good thing. It really subdivides in two. On the one hand, there's individual salvation, that people should become, individual should become a Muslim. Also, if you can't get that, at the very least, the world should be run by Islam and by Islamic law, because Islamic law, Sharia, with all that it's made up of, is the perfect system ordained by Allah through the Quran, through the Fiqh, which is the divine law, through Sharia, it's applied law, for all of mankind. Okay? So if you're not gonna be, Muslim, at least you live in a context of that's the, Voltaire would say it's le meilleur des mondes possible, or Candide would say, Pangloss would say, it's the best of all worlds. Okay, now. Because of that, the world is divided into two parts. There is the Dar al-Islam and the Dar al-Harb. There is the House of Islam, la Dur, the house which has submitted already. And the House of War, Kharev, Kharban, Kharb is the word for war in Arabic. The prime directive is to turn Dar al-Harb into Dar al-Islam. How do you do that? You do that through struggle. And the word for struggle is jihad. That's what the word means. That's how you turn Dar al-Harb to Dar al-Islam. Now, sometimes that can be done peacefully. If you can get a whole country to just come over your side, Allah kafak, do it. Generally, however, it's done through military means, and that's how it's generally been done, historically. Okay? Now, there were those who will say, that jihad is a spiritual inner process. That is true, too. If you look in Musar literature, you don't need to go to Musar literature, go to Chazal. Chazal, not infrequently, use military imagery to discuss the war against the Yetzer Hara. The Gemara in Brachos in the first parak has a whole bunch of Ma'amorei Chazal, all about how you should take a war, you should go and you should fight against the Yetzer Hara. You have a Milchemes Mitzvah against the Yetzer Hara. So in Islam you have something similar. It's not, now, we also have Milchemes Mitzvah to conquer the land of Israel. Right? There's no contradiction. One is a primary meaning and one is a secondary meaning. Similarly, spiritual jihad does exist, but that doesn't take away the fact that it's also, that this prime meaning is in fact a military political injunction. Okay? There's no contradiction. In fact, their similarities are very interesting. We have a Milchemet Mitzvah, which if you're following the Rambam, that involves all kinds of different things. Self-defense and destroying the Sheva Umos and the Amalek and conquering Eretz Yisrael. That's a Milchemet Mitzvah. There is no Milchemet Mitzvah to conquer, Lebanon north of the Latani. There's no Mitzvah to conquer anything else. I mean, that's where the Mitzvah is. So Brad Lewis, just the leading person, he's so important that Edward Said spent his life trying to debunk him and destroy him. I think he won because most of the most important Orientalists today are his students. Lewis, in an article that he published many years ago, made a brilliant chap. He says, the concept of Milchemet Mitzvah is true of Islam and of Judaism. However, it depends on who you're talking to. Jews are a single people with design on one hereditary territory. So the borders of their Milchemet Mitzvah are limited to the borders of that territory. We have no designs on anything except for Eretz Yisrael. Okay? And even then it's a question of timing. Islam is by definition a universal religion. Arabs and Arabic have a pride of place, but they are primi inter pares. They are first among equals in that regard. And therefore, since they have a universal image, their Milchemet Mitzvah in the entire world. Now, if I said this, in the States, they'd say, you're an Islamophobe. That's, by the way, Islamophobia is a made-up thing. The Bolsheviks and communists afterwards, if you didn't like Russia, so they say you're either a Russia or you're crazy because it's the most perfect place in the world, so you must be nuts. So they would put people who were dissidents either in the Gulag or they put them in mental institutions. Same thing over here. In order to be able to discredit criticism of or real, tactical issues with regard to Islamic activism, they say you're phobic. So that sort of gets rid of you right away. It's an old Bolshevik trick. In any event, so that's the prime directive. Now again, it's a question of timing. But the scope of what we're talking about is universal. Okay? And again, if you're a Muslim and you believe, then of course that's what you want. You want it for the betterment of all kinds. Christian missionaries would stop me, and I will stop you on the street, not here, it's against the law, but abroad, if you're in the States or whatever, and they say, I love you, they mean it. They mean it. It's not sympathy for me, that's my problem. But they really mean it. And the same thing over here. Islam is the way. So jihad is the way you do that. Now, there is a machlokas in Chazal, whether after the Chorban of the first temple, did the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael go away or not? Kedusha Rishon, Kedusha Shait, Kedusha Tzvot, machlokas the Rambam and the Raivit about the Beis HaMikdash, fine. There is no such machloket in Islam. Once territory has become part of the Dar al-Islam, it can never be alienated. It remains that. Hence, if they lose territory, that is not just an intolerable situation politically, that is an intolerable situation religiously. It is nothing less than blasphemy to have kafir, non-believers, rule over land that belongs to the Dar al-Islam. That is the reason why internal discussions, Hezbollah and Hamas, they all talk about not just Palestine. They talk about Al-Andalus, and they talk about the Balkans, because those are areas that were lost. Okay? It's a religious... What? Andalusia, southern Spain. That's why one of the great ironies is that the Romans lost Spain to the Vandals, who were then kicked out and pushed on to North Africa by the Visigoths, and then the area was conquered then by the Muslims until they were driven out within a process that ended on March 31st, 1492, when Ferdinand and Isabella conquered Granada, but the Arabs call the area Andalusia, which alludes to it's a corruption of the Vandals. In other words, the Visigoths didn't even get a mention. The countries, in fact, Spain today, institutionally, historically, is rooted in whatever was left of the small Visigothic Christian presence that didn't get conquered in 711 when Tariq ibn al-Aziz took his troops across to the cliff that bears his name to this day, Jebel Tariq, Tariq's Mountain, Gibraltar, and made Qasim al-Bushranis out of them. He didn't know what Qasim al-Bushranis was. No, sorry. So in other words, there's no in halachic terms, there's no hafka'ah of kedushat karka. All right, it's part of Dar al Islam. By the way, that is one of the really more interesting and not noted points in the treaties between us and Jordan and Egypt. First of all, the treaties are not in Arabic called salam, because salam you can only make with other Arabs or the Muslims. They are sulhot. They are ceasefires, which is, you know, you can have ceasefires. I don't think there's a peace treaty between Japan and the United States either. Technically, probably there's still a little war. Okay, but one of the more interesting things that happened was when the Jordanian peace was signed, there were extensive border measurements done to make sure that not one grain of Jordanian sand remained under Israeli rule, even if it was a swap. Because that is the responsibility of a Muslim king to make sure that everything under his control that belongs to him should be part of Dar al-Islam and not belong to Kafiri. That's the reason the Egyptians went ballistic over Taba. Because every last grain of sand. It's not just nationalism. Nationalism plays a role. I'm not saying not. But it's a religious principle. You'll say, I know plenty of Muslims are not Shomer Torah mitzvahs. That's true. But the question is not whether how observant they are personally. The question is, are they non-observant Orthodox Muslims or not? The idea of secular Islam, until recently there was no word for secular in Islam. So yeah, I'm not that frum. Okay. I'll drink wine, I'll drink this and that, but that. The question is, how do I organize my life from an ideological and religious? If you ask the Muslim who drinks scotch, are you a good Muslim or a bad Muslim? I'm willing to bet in the overwhelming majority of cases, he'll tell you I'm a bad Muslim. Just like if you ask a guy who's traditional, who's Michal Shabbos, are you a good Jew or a bad Jew? He'll say, I'm a bad Jew. He defines himself in terms of the person who keeps the rules. So something similar. Now you begin to have some kinds of, there's several words that are suggested for secularism in the United States. There is beginning to be some kind of secular Muslim something, but it's certainly not representative of the masses. Again, there are all kinds of Muslims and all kinds of schools and all kinds of approaches, some being very, very generalized. But I'm going for the lowest common denominator, and it's still overwhelmingly true. Yeah, absolutely. That's the whole point. You have a tremendous return to religion, to a significant degree as a reaction to what they see as the absolute licentiousness of the West. I mean, I don't know what your experience has been. I mean, my experience when we talk politics or religion with whatever Muslims I have a chance to talk to, it's interesting. The Hassan Chamula is more interested in talking religion than the Ratib Chamula, but that's those who didn't know our local color people in the Rimon. One guy said to me once, he said, I don't want this.
They all say that.
I don't want this. I look at your television. I don't want this. I don't want this for my children. I don't want this for my daughters. Chalula. I don't want, we don't want all this schmutz. Okay. And, no, they want to live in peace. No question. No, I'm not. The question of jihad. Right. So the question of jihad.
Live side by side. Leave me alone and let me live my life. The simple man in the street.
The question can they be mobilized? The other part of it is this. How quick can a person turn on a dime? Is number one. The other question, more importantly, is. The average on the street is really not, it doesn't really have that much say. I mean, they live between a rock and a hard place because they're also being squeezed by the PA and whatever. The fact that, you know, the fact that they say that the Hamas would take over the PA in a minute if they had elections says a lot. Because, yes, it's true, the corruption of the PA is horrible, but unless you could buy into Hamas, there wouldn't be anybody to vote for. Now, you could argue, Trump. I don't know. You know, I'm not a sociologist of the Arab streets, I don't know. But there is certainly from the point of view of, I know what I was gonna say. From the point of view of the overall sort of mindset, it's still very much around. Now, one more thing. Two more things. Number one is the fact that Islam, it depends on how you interpret, we're going to talk next week, we're going to talk about the other religions. Islam is very, and certainly in its present iteration, is extremely, in the dominant discourse, is very, very supersessionist. Everything that was before was either Islamic from beginning, or has become Muslim. That's why Mekomot Kedoshim cannot tolerate having prayer by non-Muslims. By the way, that's expanding. They never wanted Kevar Ochel. Now all of a sudden it's big. They're arguing that too. That's number one. Number two, I want to, in terms of this thing about jihad, it may be the prime directive. However, keep in mind, you can put things on ice. If you put a Satmar guy together with some really very militant sort of Rav Kooki type person in a room, the one thing I think they would both agree on, that there is a mitzvah in the Torah to conquer Eretz Yisrael. Have to. It's there. What's the machlokas? Timing. Right. So in other words, it's possible to, if Muslim in Al-Azhar or wherever it would be, or Al-Najah, would come out and say, now is not the time. We'll wait for the Imam, who's the Mashiach, whatever it is. You could find tools within. We, as a Rosh Hashanah, say we can't dictate somebody else's religion, just like we don't want them dictating to us. That's enough Gemina. So it's the guy from, I don't know, I'm not going to pick on a Yishuv, but some Ma'achaz, right? From some Ma'achaz says, now's the time we're going to build the basement, just going to tear down the mosque, we're going to conquer everything, and da da da. And the Satmar guy's sitting there, go, what are you talking? You're crazy. They'll agree that there's a mitzvah. The question is timing. The same thing could happen over here. Personally, it's the only way I can see a way out. Because you can't be respectful of another person's faith commitment and say, well, you don't mean it. You don't mean it. That's the most colonialist, paternalist, disrespectful stance you could possibly have. Why? Because you can't get into it? That's your problem, not me. Okay, we will finish up next time and talk about it. Please bring these with you, and we will go through.